Good afternoon and welcome to Digging Deep. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM and streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org. This is community radio from the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin. Digging Deep is a farm show that airs the last Saturday of the month and replaces Who's in the Kitchen, but with the same host. I'm Philothea Beeson, and we are going to talk today about salmon. Now, you might not think about this as a farming show. Why are we talking about salmon? But I think it'll become very clear quickly that this fits into a whole picture of farming. And so my guest is Duke Welter of Viroqua, Wisconsin. Welcome, Duke.
It's a treat to be here.
Great to have you. And Duke has been on my show several times to talk about fish, mainly trout and trout streams and local fish, because we have just a wonderful area here of fish that actually can live in streams and spawn and don't even need to be stocked, which I guess is a kind of a rarity now, that if you have clean enough and cold enough water that the fish can reproduce naturally, which would be really nice. So we're going to talk about salmon and how they fit into the picture, because I know a lot of us love to eat salmon, and we probably, most of us, don't really know where it comes from, where it's grown, what's natural, what's not, and so forth. So I'm going to turn over to Duke. He's got a lot of information for us.
Thank you, Philothea. Well, salmon are a cousin of our trout here that live in the Driftless area, but they are native to different parts of the world, and they have particular habitat needs, and they provide a tremendous source of protein for a lot of people around the world. But there are some environmentally unsustainable practices that are used in farming some kinds of salmon that have led people to look for alternative ways that are much more sustainable, one of which, interestingly, is right here in Wisconsin, about an hour away from us in the northeastern part of the Driftless area.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that maybe in a little while, but that's kind of a little teaser, because it's nice to hear something positive for a change. you were, just before the show, you were kind of giving me an idea of where salmon naturally are, where they have actually been expanded to, you know, by stocking various areas. So do salmon come both in the Pacific and the Atlantic?
Yes, there are two kinds. The Atlantic salmon, which is native to the northern Atlantic from England and Norway and Iceland around to northeastern Canada. And at one time, at the time of settlement, they extended down into the northeastern, what are now the northeastern states. But our damming of rivers and our polluting areas and overfishing have extirpated the Atlantic salmon in most of the U.S., except for a few streams in Maine. The Pacific salmon have been part of the Pacific Rim from Japan around through northeastern Russia, Alaska, British Columbia, and down the Pacific coast of the U.S. to California. Now, they have been transplanted. The Pacific salmon have been transplanted to other places where they thrive in wild, cold streams that lead out to the ocean, mm-hmm. such as New Zealand and Chile.
So salmon really needs cold water.
They need cold water. And the other thing that salmon need is they are born in clear, cold water streams that flow out to the coast. And then they come from parents who had been born in those same streams, come back from the ocean and go back to the ocean when they're small. They grow in the ocean for 3 to 5 years, and they come back up those same streams, the same little tributary where they were born, and they spawn there, and they die. Then the new smolts are born, head down the river, and out to the ocean. Now, in the ocean, there's plenty of commercial fisheries operated by by shipping or fishing companies from many countries, Japan, Norway, other countries. But the Atlantic salmon, on the other hand, you're not going to have a chance, likely in your lifetime, to eat wild Atlantic salmon.
Oh.
They're as a commercial fishery, they're banned. And so what has happened is there are companies, particularly Norwegian companies, that have developed ways of farming Atlantic salmon, and they sell them through fishing companies, and you can buy those in here in Viroqua. Mm-hmm. At the stores.
So you'll see some of the stores. On the package, it'll say farm raised.
Well, it usually mm-hmm. does, but labeling has been a real problem.
Okay.
A lot of places don't, they'll sell Atlantic salmon and it won't say that it's farm raised. Some do, some don't. Some years ago, there was a survey done of New York City restaurants that had salmon on the menu. And the investigators went in and asked to see the bills of lading of the salmon that those restaurants had bought, and regardless of whether they called them honestly farmed salmon or wild, they were all farmed, and mm-hmm. those restaurants were embarrassed by that, and they should have been.
So we see
some labeling for Atlantic salmon that says farm raised. Some says where, some doesn't. It, most of the farming is done on the coast of Norway, Scotland, northeastern Canada, Newfoundland, and then Chile, British Columbia, and it used to be along the Oregon and Washington coasts. Mm-hmm. But people are starting to realize that that kind of Atlantic salmon farming has tremendous adverse environmental impacts.
Oh.
And it's starting to be, people are starting to look for alternatives.
Mm-hmm. So, when it's wild caught, it means they're just out swimming around free.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And farming, they're actually kind of in pens or something like mm-hmm. that. I'd like you to describe this, the
sure.
conditions of the farm raised, which sounded like, well, that's kind of a cool idea. And if it's, you know, it's Norway and it's the North Sea or something like that, maybe that's really clean. But what is the condition of a farm? What's a farm fish farm like? Mm-hmm.
Well, you can. There's a. Most of those salmon are raised along coastlines in a fjord or a bay, in what's called a net pen, and those are circular contraptions that might be maybe 100 yards across. They have vertical nets that are weighed down, and they might have 600,000 salmon in those nets, and they feed them artificial food pellets that are made from ground up oily little fish like anchovies that are caught by seiners off the coast of Peru or Africa. And they have dye added to them to give the salmon that bright orange color.
Oh, so they're not naturally that color? Or they would be if they were eating wild?
If they were out running around in the ocean, they'd be eating a lot of shrimp. And shrimp have that that orange color, and they give the flesh of the fish that orange color. So when you catch a fish around here, a trout around here, and its flesh is really orange, it's been eating our little freshwater shrimp called scuds, copepods, or it's been eating crayfish, which are a nice mouthful for a fish, for a trout here. So here they are. They're raised in these pens. They don't swim in the ocean other than in circles in the pens, and they're fed these pellets, and the waste drops to the seafloor, and it is known in many areas to have smothered shellfish beds, lobster fisheries, and to kind of take over as a sort of a factory from the natural marine ecosystem.
So these fish then are kind of living in their own manure-filled water.
Yes.
And then decaying.
Both decaying fish and decaying excreta. end up dropping. And when they're in that kind of proximity, that many fish crowded together, they get something called sea lice, which attach to their gills and weaken them. But it's not enough to kill them in most cases. But what happens is in waters where there are nearby wild Pacific salmon, such as off the coast of Washington or British Columbia, the sea lice infect the Pacific salmon and they weaken them. Now, those are fish that end up going out in the ocean, and they're predator fish and they're fed on by predator fish, and anything that weakens them reduces their hardiness. And so they're a threat to the Pacific salmon populations in the area where they are. Those net pens are also subject to winds and storms, and they, when they break, they can release hundreds of thousands of Atlantic salmon into the natural environment of the Pacific salmon. That leads to spreading of more sea lice. There is some suggestion that there might be some interbreeding that might go on, but that's not that's a suggestion, not a proven thing. But be all that as it may, when these things break, it's catastrophic for the system and it's catastrophic for the native species. The state of Washington has banned them, and the last of their net pens are going to be removed by, I think, the end of this year or sometime next year. British Columbia, on the other hand, still has quite a few of them, and they're in a lot of the bays where the rivers are that the Pacific salmon go up to spawn. So they're going to be going by the polluted areas with the sea lice to get to their spawning grounds.
Well, if all these net pens were eliminated, well, that's really hard for the salmon industry, isn't it?
Well, the salmon industry is a 100 billion plus industry. It's dominated by four Norwegian companies, regardless of whether they're raising those salmon in British Columbia, Scotland, Chile. And it's net pen after net pens. And in a lot of places, they're looked at as a real boon for the local economy. But it's a boom and bust thing. If you come into a bay in Newfoundland and put in net pens, well, the local fisheries, the lobster fishery, for instance, is going to go kaput, and you end up having hardly any choice in those little fishing towns except to go work for the salmon farm. It's not good for the human ecology either. So what happens? So what benefits do we get from having thousands and thousands of tons of farmed Atlantic salmon? Well, they're a good protein source and a good source of oil in people's diets. And regardless of how they're raised, and regardless of whether they have artificial coloring to make them look like salmon, they're a not very expensive source of protein. So just this morning, I checked out the salmon in our three local food stores. And what I saw was in Walmart, they had unfrozen Atlantic salmon fillets, a slab, for $9.28 a pound. They said responsibly farm-raised. They said color added through food. They were marketed by Santa Monica Seafood. They didn't say what the source was.
They also
had farm-raised Chilean salmon sold by a Pennsylvania company at $10.88 a pound. At Quillen's, they had Norwegian salmon, didn't say Atlantic or Pacific, said Norwegian salmon, filleted sides for $12.50 a pound. No information on sourcing, whether they were farmed or artificial color. And then when you went to the co-op, there was wild-caught salmon from a company that provides the co-op. Their coho was $17 a pound. Their sockeye was about $20 a pound. And those were Pacific salmon, not Atlantic salmon. They didn't have any Atlantic salmon.
So it was wild-caught. Are they lying, or are they telling the truth?
No, they're telling the truth.
Uh-huh.
There are some companies, a number of them with Wisconsin ties, by the way, that that work the Atlantic or the Pacific salmon season in Alaska every year. They have some boats and they're trying to employ families, you know, family
right.
owned captains.
We buy ours boats. That way mm-hmm. too.
Yeah.
And they ship it by mail and they tell us about who the families are and what their life is like and mm-hmm. so forth. That would be true wild-caught salmon.
Wild-caught salmon. By you know who caught it. You know where it came from.
Uh-huh.
You pay a little bit more for it, but it's good quality salmon. So everybody can't afford to go to Alaska and fish at a lodge and or just do your own trip to Alaska and come back with coolers full of fresh frozen salmon. Some people do. I knew a teacher from Eau Claire that would go up every summer and try to catch mm-hmm. and bring back 300 pounds of salmon. He always paid for his trips by doing that.
Wow.
If Pacific salmon is somewhat more expensive, what do you do? You've got Atlantic salmon that are being farmed around the rims of the oceans in places that they conflict with native salmon populations, in places that they degrade the local environment, and that you don't exactly get much information about what you're getting. Or maybe you can afford a subscription service. People are looking for alternatives, and one of them, it turns out, by the way, if anybody wants to see a documentary about the net pens, Patagonia did a documentary about 3 years ago called Artificial, Artificial. And it's the net pen story, and it's dramatic, and it's ugly. And part of it publicized the failure of these Washington State net pens that led to Washington State banning the practice completely. So that's a good start. There's also a really good book that came out 2 years ago called Salmon Wars, and it's by Douglas France and Catherine Collins, who are experienced investigative journalists. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and they looked at the economics and the environmental impacts. Salmon Wars. It should be at the Viroqua Library if it isn't yet. And they looked around the world to try and find more sustainable ways of raising Atlantic salmon. And interestingly, they found one close to us here at Hixton on Highway 94. If you're driving up 94, look off to your left up on the hilltop. You'll see a big green pole shed and usually some cranes that are probably building another pole shed. And that's the home of Superior Fresh Salmon. It's one of the few inland salmon-raising concerns in the U.S. or anywhere, although other places are trying to figure out how to do it. It took some money to put it together, and it is owned by the Wanick family from Arcadia that owns Ashley Furniture, which is right now advertising itself as the world's largest manufacturer of furniture. So they decided to try this and to use the abundant water in that area, high quality water, to support that salmon fishery.
So how could they do that? They're not on a coast. They need clean water, mm-hmm. Cold water. They've got mm-hmm. that. But how do they keep from getting into the same problem that the fisheries,
salmon are one of those fish that can live in freshwater part of their lives and saltwater part of their lives. They need that mm-hmm. freshwater for spawning and as juveniles, and then they need the saltwater, which has much more abundant food sources for their adult period. And so they had to figure out some ways of raising those fish in freshwater and not having to manage it like you would a saltwater aquarium, which is a tetchy situation. It's really persnickety to keep the water right. So they're raising them in all freshwater, and they're It's a double purpose farming facility because they can raise, as of the time of salmon wars, they could raise about 600,000 salmon a year, about 70 tons. And but they use the water then to water a salad greens operation growing hydroponically. Mm-hmm. And they sell the salad greens in stores around the region as Superior Fresh salad greens. And they sell the salmon as Superior Fresh salmon. And they recycle their water. If they have any wastes that are filtered out of that water, they put them out into some areas where they can supplement the soil and help wetlands regenerate. So they're reusing their water. They're sending the little bit of waste out to places it's not causing any damage and it might be helping grow things. And they're turning out high-quality lettuce greens and what I would call pretty darn good Atlantic salmon.
Have you tasted it?
Yes, I have.
Oh,
yes, I have.
Wow.
I've tried it, and I have it. I get it when I want some at Festival Foods, which is one of their outlets around the region.
Mm-hmm.
And it's usually somewhere in between the Chilean farm-raised Atlantic salmon and the wild-caught Pacific salmon that you get from Alaska.
In between, in what way?
In prices.
In price.
It might be $16 or $17 a pound, and it's a good flesh, and it can, you know, salmon to me is like halibut. You can cook it in a lot of different ways, and it takes to herbal preparations. It takes to, you know, dill and lemon, very, very simple. It takes to being basted with maple syrup, you know, just about all those things. Well, actually, being basted with birch syrup isn't bad either, if you can get it. So they're on a track that is really intriguing. Mm-hmm. They don't use those fish pellets. There's a lot of experimentation going on around that industry that's interested in sustainable Atlantic salmon farming, trying to find food sources that don't deplete native stocks in Peru or off the coast of Senegal, where the native population has, the human population has relied on those for decades.
For their own food.
Yeah, absolutely. And and so they're using products made from a whitefish processing facility out on the West Coast. So it's stuff that would be otherwise thrown away. So you can use, you know, skin or or whatever parts. And that I think they're also looking at whether or not they can use offal from chicken processing for these salmon to feed on. Which would be really kind of interesting, because if you look at that whole area in Trempealeau County, from Osseo down to Arcadia, there's a gazillion chicken processing operations there. Mm-hmm. And being able to do something constructive with their offal that otherwise would have to go through wastewater treatment plants or into landfills is not a bad recycling mechanism if it can work.
Mm-hmm.
They're also trying to find out whether there are ways that they can feed these salmon ocean vegetation stuff, like abundant ocean weeds. We're not trying to harvest whole kelp beds or something like that, which are challenged in their own right. But whether or not there's ocean vegetation that they can use to supplement that diet, and there are some good restaurants around that are serving that, and I don't have a problem with that as long as they identify where it's coming from, because I think as more people become conversant with it, they're going to say it's better ecologically and sustainably in farming terms. Mm-hmm. Than those net pens, which are nothing but a problem, and you pay a few dollars more for it, but it's good quality meat.
Well, this word sustainable and regenerative, we're really realizing it applies to all kinds of farming practices with animals and crops and the soil and the water. It just sounds like if it's too intense and animals are grown too close together, confined in these situations. I mean, you could be an animal rights person, be upset about it, or you could also be, you could be a local fisherman who's upset about, or say a lobster fisherman or something who's been impacted by that, or being crowded out by large corporations and the small fishermen are being displaced. Or you could be concerned because you want quality fish and you don't want fish that have been raised in a place that's just really full of fish waste and manure and so forth. So a lot of people are concerned about this. And you could also just relate this to other farming that's also, putting a lot of chickens together and they can't move, and or putting a lot of cows together, or veal. I've just been reading about veal and how these little veal calves are just contained. They can't even turn around in their cages. There does seem to be a concern that raising livestock, raising fish and animals and birds can it be done sustainably, instead of in such a way that it's really, really just harmful to the environment in so many ways. So I'm going to just take a break and let you know that you're listening to Digging Deep, a farming show here on WDRT. I'm Philothea Beeson, your host, and my guest is Duke Welter from Viroqua, who's in Trout Unlimited and has been just devoted to fish and wildlife for many, many years of his life, and done a lot of volunteering in this regard, and soil conservation, water conservation, just always been interested in this. So this is WDRT Community Radio from the Driftless Area, 91.9 FM. And we're just a community radio station with a bunch of volunteers who put on these shows and also bring you music. So thank you so much for tuning in. And we're going to get back to talking about salmon and maybe a more sustainable way to do this. This sounds very hopeful to me, and maybe this model can be imitated in other areas of farming. It seems like, people are, hate government regulation. And yet, it seems like if businesses aren't regulated along certain lines for health reasons and pollution and so forth, they tend to go for the money, go for the greatest profit, and maybe at the expense of other things that need to be considered. And so this whole idea of sustainable, that you're actually giving back, or it's circular, and so that your manure, which is very useful in the right proportion to the environment, can be used to raise crops or to raise lettuce or so forth in a facility. And they are doing aquaponics this way with aquaponics when the
hydroponic
are being raised on the byproducts of the fish, right?
Yes, and I think we have places in Wisconsin where people are trying to make progress with aquaculture, mm-hmm. and the Red Cliff Band and UW up on Lake Superior and UW Stevens Point have an aquaculture facility in the Bayfield Peninsula that's focused on raising walleyes. Walleyes aren't the easiest thing to raise in aquaculture, and there's plenty of demand for them, and we get a fair amount of walleyes for our restaurants from either well-managed tribal fisheries like Red Lake in northern Minnesota, mm-hmm. or Lake Winnipeg. Some of those are mostly tribal fisheries, but if you go to the Tavern on Grand in the Twin Cities, they serve more walleye than a lot of most other states do, and they really specialize in it. And so trying to make sure that you have that population wild caught is a challenge, and sometimes suppliers can't keep up with it. You know, we saw that too in Green Bay with fish fries that for a century after the areas in Brown and Kewaunee and Door counties were settled by European settlers, they had heavily Catholic. They would have the Friday night fish fry with lake perch from Green Bay or Lake Michigan was an absolute standard. But you know, as that fishery in Lake Michigan changed, beginning with the influx of the lampreys that killed off the lake trout back in the late 50s and swamped that area with alewives and smelt and those sorts of things. And then they introduced introduced salmon and rainbow trout and brown trout from hatcheries to eat the alewives for the most part. And the salmon did the thing. They got to be 40 pounds in no time, and they ate off the pestilential smelt and alewives that used to die and form these big mounds of dead fish on the shores of Sheboygan and Milwaukee and all those places. So that's a completely artificial fishery. But anyway, the upshot of that was it really killed off a lot of the lake perch, and that meant it was you'd have the ignominious situation of going into a fish fry in Belgium or Luxembourg, Wisconsin, and you had to eat cod. My God, what a terrible thing that was. Well, anyway. Trying to find fish-based protein without environmental impacts and at reasonable costs to fit in with people's, accustomed dietary preferences. That's a serious challenge.
Mm. Well, we are all recommended to eat fish two or three times a week and so forth. And it is a challenge to say, gee, all I have is farm raised, and it doesn't sound like that's a very healthy. You know, how could it be healthy? Or say tuna. I mean, we know that some of these swordfish and tuna have a lot of heavy metals in them now. I don't know if you can talk about that, but we're supposed to eat fish, but not these fish or not those fish. And
well, and some fish get stylish too.
Some fish gets
stylish. Black and red fish. Popularized by New Orleans chefs, led to a diminution of redfish populations, and they had to figure out what they could do. Chilean sea bass, which used to have some other name like pigfish or something, as those got really popular, that population became overfished. We have to worry about that with our natural populations out there, and so it makes sense to try and find a way that you can responsibly and economically farm fish that lend themselves to it. Now, if we lived in northern Mississippi, chances are that out in the back behind your place, they have a lot more flat places down there than around your place, Philothea. You'd have a pond, and it would have catfish in it. And you could go out any morning and catch a few catfish and have them for lunch or dinner. And that was a kind of fish farming that was pretty sustainable. I've always liked pond catfish from Alabama or Mississippi, and I try to have it when I'm down that way because, we don't exactly have that option up here. But make no mistake about it. It's going to take some significant dollars to try and do these inland salmon raising facilities, and the family that's doing Superior Fresh is equipped to do that. Mm-hmm. But when you compare the amount of money that they have into it to the amount that these big Norwegian companies have into it, they have way, 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 way more money going into those net pen operations around the Atlantic and the Pacific than is going into this little operation at Hixton, Wisconsin, that raises 70 tons a year. And so, you know, looking at it and saying, well, it's this big and this is what it's going to cost. In comparison to the big Norwegian companies, it's a blip. It's just a tiny amount.
But it could be a model.
It could be a model in a lot of places. And I don't know if you can do it in Arizona, where they haven't got enough water anyway. But there are places you could. Mm-hmm. And so we could become an important place for supplying a decent salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a long ways from causing those adverse impacts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of optimistic about it. And this fall, we're trying. Our Coulee Region Trout Unlimited chapter is working to put together a dinner with a local chef who sure knows how to cook salmon to have a discussion about this.
Okay,
not just the cooking, but the environmental impacts and the economics and all those sorts of things.
Great. Wouldn't that be nice to actually come up with something that's a positive answer? I mean, so encouraging. And I feel like you are going to be critical. I mean, obviously, you're going to be critical of this because you're aware of the harm that it can do if it's not done right.
I think they're making nice steps trying to address some of the concerns. And I don't know if they're at the end point where they say, boy, this is as good as it's going to get. We can make a living doing this. We can provide decent mm-hmm. quality salmon at reasonable prices. Let's just keep doing it like this. I think they're going to continue to have things that they need to address mm-hmm. as they go forward, food mm-hmm. sources and make sure the environmental impacts are as benign as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you also mentioned about regulation. That's an interesting question. In Wisconsin, our fish farms are regulated by the State Department of Agriculture. There was a lot of angst 30 years ago when the governor and the legislature, in their wisdom, took oversight of those aquaculture operations away from the DNR and assigned them to the Department of Agriculture.
Oh.
Now, the DNR's responsibility is to keep our waters clean and our natural resources cared for, and they were working to do that. They certified those or licensed those fish farms and oversaw them. Putting them under the Department of Agriculture meant that it became part of the Department of Agriculture's charge, as they saw it, to do as an economic development agency more than a regulator. And so there has been concern over the years about, you know, how they would be able to do that and you know, what kind of agriculture or aquaculture regulations were going to be put in place and what was the oversight like. Now that's one aspect of this, and I think that the State Department of Agriculture is probably the regulating agency, the overseeing agency for the Superior Fresh operation, and I trust that they're doing the kind of monitoring that they need to. But of course, that's a question that you want to ask about when you have the chance, and I don't know the answer to it for certain. But just based on 30 years of practice, I'm assuming that they are doing what they do. And they may be having to make the rules as they go along because there aren't any other indoor salmon raising facilities
in
the state.
Right. How interesting.
The other legal area that is interesting here is the concentration in those big Norwegian firms around the world of all the Atlantic salmon ocean net pen aquaculture. And they own, like I said, about 80% of that industry. And they have a huge amount of power. It makes me wish for an effective antitrust mechanism that existed at the international level. We haven't had strong antitrust enforcement in this country for almost 40 years. I considered it a shame because in the 1970s I studied a lot of antitrust history, and antitrust is the idea that when a single business or a small group of businesses comes to dominate on industry. They can engage in unfair practices, they can drive out competition, and they can drive up prices as much as they want to. And those were called back in the Teddy Roosevelt era and the Bob La Follette era, those were called the trust. And there was a sugar trust and a flour trust and steel trust, steel makers, and they needed some kind of regulation to control those so that they didn't get so strong and so dominating that that industry was all out of whack. And from that came our first antitrust regulation in 1912, the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice's antitrust unit. Mm-hmm. Well, in the 1980s, they started to dismantle that, which was a shame. And it is a shadow of what it once was. Although sometimes if Google decides it's going to merge with Meta, they'll take a look at it and they'll say, no, we're not going to let you do that because that's going to mean you're going to have one dominating company in this industry. In the international antitrust area, something like that would help try and figure out how to require those companies to do other things that weren't so damaging in a lot of ways. And obviously they can use their market power to convince governments in Chile or British Columbia to have relaxed regulation. And that's not good for us. It may be really good for them.
Yeah, that is always the problem in capitalism, I guess, is just the balance between good practices and making enough of a profit to stay in business and keep on going and expanding. And so it just, it's always walking that fine line, but just, anti-regulation. We know that a lot of things have been done to really protect the public by having regulations on all kinds of things. And when you oppose regulation just per se, I mean, we could have ridiculous regulations. We could have regulations that really strangle businesses. Often they strangle the little businesses, though, as much or more than they do the great big corporations. But I'm inserting a little bit of my opinion.
I gotcha.
But I just want to let you know that I'm talking to Duke Welter. I'm Philothea Beeson. We are talking about, the whole salmon picture and based kind of on this book, Salmon Wars, by Douglas France and Catherine Collins, The Dark Underbelly of Our Favorite Fish. And to realize, to help us as consumers and eaters of salmon and other fish, to really understand what it means for a fish to come from a fish farm. Who knew what a fish farm was like, and that maybe it might not be a good thing for anybody. But that's how almost all our salmon is raised. And is that true of other fish too? I mean, it's not just salmon, is it?
Well, Atlantic salmon that is sold is, I believe, exclusively farmed. I don't think there is such a thing as a wild-caught Atlantic salmon that you can buy.
Oh.
And that's changed in 100 years. In the 1920s, the first 30 years of this century, the President of the United States would be shipped the first Atlantic salmon caught on one of the famous rivers up in Labrador or Newfoundland, and they'd pack it in ice and they'd catch it on the Restigouche or wherever it was of Miramichi and send it down by fast packet boat to Washington and deliver it to the president. And so Coolidge and Taft and Roosevelt, they all got their pictures taken with one of these Atlantic salmon.
Oh.
Now,
and why aren't there wild-caught Atlantic salmon?
Well, overfishing is one. Habitat loss is another. Dams are a huge one. Dam removals, sometime we might talk about this, Philothea, but not today very much. Dam removals on some of the streams that have been dammed for since the 1830s and 40s for one kind of power or another, interrupt that salmon migration.
And even why does that happen?
Well, even though there were laws in place requiring that fish ladders be put in place, they were most often disregarded.
So the fish ladders are to allow fish to get back up into their spawning ground, right?
Yep.
And dams make the water warmer.
Dams do.
And so the fish need to get to the cold water of the fresh flowing streams and springs. And so the dams, the dams have one, you know, they have many, many positive things. But they have this effect also on wildlife.
Well, and they...
food.
When the smolts go downstream, the young salmon go downstream, a lot of them end up going through the turbines and being... chopped into salmon burger, and so in some salmon rivers, notably the Columbia, that is really heavily dammed by the big hydro dams, the salmon and steelhead runs are waning because the dams pose such a hindrance to the migration, and in those areas, there have been some successes. So, if I look at the Penobscot in Maine, that drains about a third of the middle part of Maine, 1,500 miles of spawnable water, they took out two dams and refitted two others with much more effective fish ladders in the last few years. And what they found not only is that there are a slowly increasing number of Atlantic salmon that are coming in to spawn, but there are millions of other ocean-run fish that haven't been able to run up those rivers for over a century. Shad and herring, very rich species and an abundant, or I'm sorry, a critical part of those ecosystems. They've been stopped by the dams for 150 years. And now that the Penobscot is basically freed, there's grounds for optimism.
Wow.
On the other hand, all the rivers down the East Coast through Massachusetts and that little chunk of New Hampshire and Rhode Island and Connecticut and New York, all those rivers have been dammed forever since the 1820s and 30s. And when you achieve dam removal on some of those rivers, maybe that only frees it up 6 miles up to the next dam, and so there's a real push to save the Pacific salmon that run up the Columbia, which is a huge river that has a huge number of tributaries that are kind of blocked off by the dams, and the Snake River there are four dams on the Snake River that. Mm-hmm. Oh, Trout Unlimited has been pushing to remove since the late 90s.
Well, you sound like troublesome environmentalists.
I'm a troubled environmentalist in that regard. For me, healthy rivers are a really important thing, and we can see that here in the Driftless area. Our rivers have been beat up since this area was being settled, and especially in that period from 1890 to the 30s, when people started to do something about it. Well, there are actors, there are groups with even more of a stake in some of these salmon things, and one of them is the tribes of the Pacific Northwest. They base their culture on salmon. They base their culture on salmon runs that it was said you could walk across that stream on the backs of the salmon without getting your feet wet when they were in there. And I've seen some of these little streams that are, they might be only 10 feet wide, and they would have thousands of salmon spawning in them. And the tribes used them for their food, their religious rituals. They used them for their skins for their raincoats. And the ecosystems that those salmon ran in were fed by the salmon, not just the fact that bears would eat the salmon when they were dying, which I've watched them do in Alaska and other places, but the eagles feed on the dying salmon, and the mink, and the the smaller carrion-eating fish.
Oh, you don't think about that.
And the bugs. And so the measurable difference in protein in those environments is astonishing. They're parched. They're starved of that protein because the salmon runs went from tens of thousands to 10 fish. So when you start to talk about a cultural impact, a lot of people will treat, I mean, if I don't think the Tlingit and the Klickitat in Washington thought of it as their economy more than their culture, because they didn't think in economic terms, but they found food and sustenance and religious awareness and, you know, just a cultural strength of their cultures.
They had such a sense of connection.
To their credit, the tribes have been in many places front row advocates for freeing these rivers and for, you know, for saying, let's protect those salmon, those Pacific salmon, by getting rid of net pens.
Okay, so the dams were built, one for hydroelectric power and two for creating reservoirs to what?
Well, they're to some extent for irrigation, but on some big rivers like the Snake and the Columbia, they were built for transporting grain from Idaho and eastern Washington downriver to ports like Portland.
I see.
And so there's each dam has a lock, and those barges go down.
So So is there a way for dams to coexist with? You're saying the Penobscot example is you can restructure the dams.
So there's
without
better
just
fish
totally
passing.
Taking out the dams, which seems like unbelievable, but or taking out some dams, but having describe that again.
If a dam is there as a power source for an industry like a paper mill, let's say, and it can get its enough power by only running part of the river's flow through the powerhouse, so that the rest of the river is free. You don't have to dry up that river with a dam or impound the whole thing. And that's been done in some places, but it's not always a feasible alternative. In other places, like the big dam dam removal project that's going on right now is on the Klamath River, which starts in southern Oregon, southeastern Oregon, and it flows into California and out to the ocean. And it's been for 150 years managed mostly by the ranchers and farmers that are up in that area. And the tribes have said, wait a minute, we have a treaty right to a viable salmon run, and the way that you've dammed this and used the water means there is no viable salmon run. Now let's figure it out. And they've been wrestling about it for 30 years, and they finally got an agreement to remove all four of those dams.
Really?
First one this fall and the rest next season. And that, you know, they figured out ways that it's not a loss for the people who use that water for irrigation. They're finding other ways to get them water. And the tribe has been, you know, just four square in its support of the dam removals. And they do have a legal right that's guaranteed them by their treaties, as do the tribes in Oregon and Washington, and they are willing to stand on that right. You know, you're going to have a free Klamath, which is a remarkable resource, in 2 years.
Wow. Well, we'll see what happens. But I think, you know, there was a kind of thinking in the 20th century of just development, you know, for business purposes and for profit and so forth. And now, yes, we are now looking at the balance for nature, the environment, and so forth, which is a different way of thinking, actually. And it could be really better in the long run. But there's all interests, you know, economic interests, business interests that are probably, you know, pulling the other way.
Well, we could talk about the Colorado River as well, because and with the longstanding drought in the area that Colorado flows through, that waters not only Colorado, but Arizona, Nevada, and California.
Right. Water is going to be just a huge concern. Yeah. It is now, and it will continue to be.
And the water's getting so low that the big dams on the Colorado and the lower Colorado, Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon, are just at a little bit of water more than they need to continue generating electricity.
Oh, my goodness.
So they not only have the electrical generation, but the water production that are serious problems. Those reservoirs are down significantly.
And this is another big topic for Digging Deep, our farming show. So water is a big part of farming and our lives. And as someone said, we all live downstream. Right?
No doubt about it.
So I'm so happy that I was able to have Duke Welter on our show. Thank you so much, Duke, for coming and sharing with us what you understand of the situation and making us aware of Salmon Wars, which is a book, and some documentaries, if you mention those again.
Yes, Artificial, Patagonia documentary about net pen farming.
Okay.
It's very informative and dramatic.
Okay. So thank you so much, my listeners, for tuning in to Digging Deep on WDRT Community Radio, coming to you from the Driftless Area, 91.9 FM. And you can listen to this show and previous shows on our podcast by going to the archives at WDRT.org. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week from Who's in the Kitchen?